Good evening. Well, from the writer's point of view, writing can often feel like a very solitary activity, I think. You sit quietly at your desk making sentences. So events such as the Writers at Warwick series are a good opportunity for authors to get out of the study and to meet their public. Sadly, however, these meetings aren't always characterized by politeness and good temper. The novelist Paul Mars tells the story of the time when he gave a reading with Maggie G in King's Lynn. Paul was reading one of his filthy short stories, as he calls them. He ended up being heckled by a terrible old man who flew into a state of rage when he read his story about a gay man. Well, I hope there aren't any hecklers or indeed terrible old men among tonight's audience. It's my very great pleasure to introduce Maggie G, the author of seven novels, including The Burning Book and Lost Children. She's been a writing fellow at the University of East Anglia, a visiting fellow at Sussex University, and like all the best people you can hope to meet in life, she's a regular contributor to the books pages of the Daily Telegraph. Tonight,
sorry about that.
Somebody's got to. Tonight she's going to read from a number of her novels, including her new book, which isn't yet published. Indeed, this is the first time it's been read anywhere in its finished state. After the formal reading, there'll be a question and answer session, and following that, you'll have an opportunity to buy some of these books that are down here and to get them signed. But before we do that, perhaps you'll join me in welcoming Maggie G.
Well, hello, it's very nice to be here. And thank you for coming out on a day when I gather there's a strike, isn't there, against the imposition of student fees, with which, of course, I am in total solidarity with the students. But I hope this isn't strike-breaking, being here. I'm going to start by reading from my last published novel, which is called Lost Children. If you don't know my work, I write about the present and the future insofar as our present is always turning into the future. I haven't really written about the past. To me, the great challenge for a writer is to understand the present in different ways to the ways in which journalists and politicians tell us stories about the present. And it's to find metaphors that are truthful for the present. That's what really excites me. And I think at the moment I'm slightly a square peg in a round hole because a lot of contemporary fiction seems to be turning towards the past, the recent 20th century past and also the 19th century. And a lot of it is basing itself quite closely on biography. Well, I like to make things up from first principles and I like to write about now. And Lost Children is set in London, and it's about various kinds of lost children. It begins as a teenage girl runs away from home. I think I chose this topic because I have one daughter who I adore, like all parents adore their children, and writing is partly a way of dealing with your fears. And of course, I suppose my worst fear would be of losing my own child. But I think the impulses for novels are always both personal, and then you hope you move them outward so that there's a space where you're communicating with a wider audience. And of course, if you live in London, you're living in a city of homeless children. So I'm also writing about all lost children. Perhaps also, as it's a novel of middle age is often a time when you start thinking about your own childhood and understanding it in different ways. I think all parents who lose a child seem to be forced back upon their own childhood to try and understand what's gone wrong. And so that lost child is also a child inside the mother, Alma, who loses her daughter. What if nothing is lost, nor can ever be lost? What if all of time is still happening? What if we are the kind of creature we dream of being, finding the grey defeated sister, so badly married, so beaten down. A child again, straight and slim, doing handstands in the dandelions down the greenback garden. If only we could slip from the room for a second. Maybe we could wake with the French windows flung wide and walk out into the landscape we have just dreamed, stretching away in every direction, perspectiveless, dazzling, unbounded, peopled. What if the children are there already? Millions of them, the uncountable lost ones, loud as life, running, laughing, sun on the black, the ash blonde, the auburn. Myself, yourself, my mother, my father, still young, still potential, all the lost children. One day, Alma found Zoe had gone one morning, her beautiful daughter. She'd left a note at the top of the stairs. Alma picked it up, absently tidying in her sleep, glanced at it as she threw it in the bin. Picked it out, started reading, couldn't breathe. She ran into Zoe's room, which was empty. Impossible, but Zoe had gone. She was 16, and the note said nothing. Paul, help me, help me, Paul! Still half asleep, Paul stumbled in and stared at her as she stood open-mouthed in the brilliant room, startled eyes like polished coals, both hands clutching her bird-thin clavicles as if they would wrench her bones from her body. Help me, help me! Alma screamed to no one, turned away from Paul, turned inward, sobbing. But Alma had always been hard to help, because she was always helping other people, putting them first. I don't want to be selfish, she always said. I mustn't be selfish. I really don't mind. I like to help. Whatever you want. Doesn't matter to me. It's not important. But underneath, another voice whispered, nibbled, I'd like to be selfish, but I don't know how. I do mind what happens. I don't want to help. Why can't someone help me for a change? How about what I want? Doesn't that matter? There's something important I keep on missing. I can't be myself. I've lost it somewhere. One day when Zoe was 13 or 14, Alma heard the voice shouting furiously at her husband, who stood in his overcoat, white with shock. I am a person, you know. I'm not a fixture. I do have feelings. You don't notice I'm here. Her hand clapped over her lips at once. She felt herself reddening. She started to cry. Paul was looking at her as if she'd gone mad. I'm sorry, she whispered. I'm not myself. You're the most important person in this house, he fussed, stroking her arm, giving her a hanky. Without you, this house just wouldn't function. None of us could cope without you, Alma. Never think I'm not grateful, darling. He paused. She said nothing. Nothing came. The window behind him was a heavenly blue, the stupid blue of eternity, where the word that mattered would never be spoken. The thing that was lost could never be found. There were four in the family. A family of four. Four's a good number, said Paul. He often said the same things too, because they were a comfort and held time together, things you could go on believing through time. What's so good about it? Alma asked very loudly and suddenly, one day, soon after the other voice was born. What do you mean, darling? He was anxious. Oh, nothing. Nothing at all. Families aren't so great, the little voice grumbled, and this family isn't so wonderful either. Four is too many, but also too few. Trapped, forever, forever four. They had running jokes, running quarrels. They ate their food, they cleared away. Adam ate too little, Zoe too much. Alma shopped and cooked, cooked and shopped. They watched each other, growing older. But it wasn't eternal. It wasn't unstoppable. The four-strong family wasn't, as it seemed, a four-legged table, well-built, light oak, on which endless meals advanced and retreated. One morning, Alma found Zoe had gone. gone one morning with her sleeping bag and her waterproofs, and time broke down. Time stopped for all of them when Zoe left. Time stopped and broke, and they had to muddle on, though the future had grown dark and today was endless, and now no one wanted to live in the present. Everyone wanted to creep back into the past and curl up in the kindness of some unremembered moment, some moment they never knew they'd need to remember, when Zoe was there, chattering, yawning, sitting on the stairs with the sun on her cheek, when life was full because the loved one was there, but it seemed so normal that no one noticed, only to understand too late. Looking back, Alma felt she had never understood anything until it was gone. Life had speeded up since she was a child. Now it rushed her pell-mell into the future, unable to see forwards, staring at the past, never realizing what was to be left behind until the fingers had loosened and the moment was gone and the loved face dwindled, too small to console her. I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to read now from, this is quite brave because I haven't read from it in public before, it's the novel called The Ice People, which is going to be published this September by Richard Cohen Books. This is my first book that's set entirely in the future. And yet, I'm actually writing about the present. As far as I can understand it, everything that's in this book is an extension from the present. We begin in the mid-21st century. And I imagine a world, because my theory about human beings is that we always get it wrong. We always look out for the wrong danger. And so I imagine a world where the continuation of global warming goes on to a certain point, as we envisage. But then, because we're in fact at the end of an interglacial period, I imagine an ice age coming, and coming very fast. This is based upon scientific possibility. Study of the pollen record shows that in fact ice ages can come in 20 years. So they can come very fast indeed. And we are just about due for an ice age. So looking at things in a longer perspective, our worries about global warming, though of course we have to address them. I'm not paid by big business to come and tell you we don't have to worry about global warming. Nevertheless, an ice age may be on the way. I call it the ice people for various reasons, the most obvious one, of course, being that they're in an ice age. But I've always been interested in the relationships between the genders, between men and women. I write through men as well as through women. And I very much believe that as we write and read, we discover the male parts of ourselves if we're female and the female parts of ourselves if we're male. I think writing and reading are a kind of playground where we can find other parts of ourselves, unacted parts of ourselves, as Virginia Woolf said. My people are ice people partly because the genders have grown apart almost completely, through a process that they call segging. Segging is a kind of slang term. The root of this is that fertility has dropped very far. This is a trope of many modern novels because fertility is dropping. Women don't have much time for men when they can't reliably get babies from them. And the rare children who are there are looked after by groups of women who cluster around these rare and often sickly children. And the men, lacking love and lacking status, the status that comes from being a father and being a husband and a partner, all those things, increasingly turn to computers and they become cyber, they're cyber jocks, and also a lot of them become gay simply through lack of heterosexual sexual partners. So I envisage a world where the genders have become very separate. I also call this novel The Ice People because my hero is mixed race without being particularly aware of being mixed race. His grandfather was Ghanaian. And if you imagine a world where suddenly the temperatures change. Instead of Britain being paranoid about Africans or people from hot countries trying to get into Britain, what's going to happen if an ice age comes? Suddenly everything's going to be reversed, isn't it? And white people and British people and Europeans are going to be trying to fight their way into Europe. So that's one of the central tropes of the book as well. It's a kind of joke, of course, but... Okay. I, Saul, teller of tales, keeper of doves, slayer of wolves, shall tell the story of my times, of the best of days and the end of days, of the new white world that has come upon us, for whoever will read it, for whoever can read. I'm sitting in the half dark by the fire. A circle of eyes reflects the firelight. The wild children surrounding me, not a circle really, too regular, they crowd and bulge outwards and fight and crow. Kit and Jojo and Fink and Porker and some who have roars and grunts for names. They're eating something. That familiar smell, delicious because all food is delicious, then fatty, sweetish, sickening. They see I am writing. Their eyes flicker. Beyond them, it's black to the horizon, where the afterglow of sunset is brighter than before. The unearthly radiance beyond is coming closer, like the deep new cold, a ring of fire from a ring of ice. I'm an old man now, old for these times, over 60. Not long ago, people lived more than twice that long, if they were rich and lucky enough not to be terminated. In the easy days, the long hot days, when there were so many human beings. I'm not afraid to die. This morning I saw it coming, or did I dream it? The white bear with a cub beside it, lolloping, joyful, glass bright in the sunlight. Why should I be afraid? I have lived through interesting times. I have been loved by a woman and a child. I have seen the world change utterly, perhaps forever. I have had a son, who is now a god. I have lived through great adventures. I have crossed the Pyrenees in deep snow, fought off the wolves side by side with my son, rode across Spain on the waves of blossom, from north to south, from winter to spring. I have seen almond blossom, cherry blossom, orange blossom, whitening the blazing skies, following the seasons down to the sea. No, I'm not afraid to go. Yet I shiver a little when their eyes turn on me. Writing fascinates them and makes them jealous. Sometimes they pretend to copy me. A few of them can do it, clumsily. Jojo can do it and speak in sentences. He lived inside till he was 12. More of them can read, perhaps 6, a dozen, though I doubt if they've ever read a book. They wouldn't even know the word. They look at me expectantly, waiting for me to tell my story. They like stories about love and adventure, and my story is full of love and adventure. But how can they ever understand? I shall tell this story for myself, and for Luke, perhaps, should he survive, if these packs of wolves let their god survive. For Sarah, yes, dead or alive. I tell this story because I must. The wild boys dance between me and the fire, and the cold increases suddenly. I am an ancestor to them. Quite soon now, they will celebrate me. But perhaps my story will keep me alive. Perhaps they will let me finish my story. They want me to tell them about the future. I tell them I'd better stick to the past. Human beings have always foretold the future. Self-deluders, wishful thinkers. I used to do it all the time, obscenely self-confident, a techno teacher. I told my pupils about global warming. I told them why we were so bloody hot, why despite all our efforts it could only get hotter. Well, as I say, let's stick to the past. Let's hear how the old world turned into this. Me and the wild boys shivering here in the shell of an abandoned airport. The fires that keep us warm are steadily burning their way through the airline's abandoned fixtures, old desks and partitions collapsing like foam, carpets unravelling in thick black fumes. By day we don't need them. By day we keep busy. If you're not busy these days, you die. We share this airport with hundreds of doves. Maybe no one in future will know what they are, our mechanical friends, our robot loves. My doves, my dears, how you once obsessed me. My love of machines drove poor Sarah wild. Once I thought their descendants would outnumber ours, and who knows, they might do one day in Euro. We know how many doves escaped, and some of the escapees must have survived. Mutating as they were designed to do, maybe the doves will have the last laugh yet out in this strange new frozen world. But I don't think so. They have their limits. And here in the airport, they don't look good. They crouch in rows, looking dull and lifeless, so the wild boys grow bored with them, and I am too tired to maintain them all. Fleets of them, quiet now, heads bowed, wings back. But if you had seen them in their heyday, those amazing, brilliantly successful inventions, doves, the wings of a brave new world. And me, white-haired Saul, when I was dark and dashing, and beautiful Sarah with her waterfall of hair. Time to begin at the beginning. I, Saul, teller of tales, keeper of doves, slayer of wolves, bring you the story of my glory days. Now, these doves, in case you haven't guessed, are robots. And they are rather cozy, lovable, friendly doves, because they're taking the place, really, of children. They are household robots. They are both very useful. They do housework, which is a very useful thing. But they're also... they are touchy-feely, they feel warm, and they use nanotechnology, which, as you know, is dwarf technology, to be able to replicate themselves. I know that Warwick is the place where an awful lot of work is done on robots, so I hope nobody's going to leap up and say, not feasible, because my understanding is something like that probably will be feasible very soon. And I think I'm just going to read you another short passage from this book, when the first dove is delivered to Saul, and at this stage he is still uneasily together with Sarah, rather unhappily together with Sarah, and they have a sickly child called Luke. They delivered it while we were out. The guard hailed me when I came home. Enormous piece of furniture for you, sir. New screen, is it? Feeling wealthy? Not after buying this, I told him. I took it up in the lift with me. To my surprise, it felt tremendously exciting. Though why is that surprising? It was exciting. For decades, we had been promised this, robots to live with us as friends. I decided not to open it till Sarah came home. But then Luke was brought back from school by a neighbor, and he saw the big package and could not wait. Please, Dad, you said I could play with it. Yes, but we said it was a present for Mummy. But Mummy said it was for you as well. He kept walking round it and poking it till I used his impatience as a cover for my own. If you insist, we'll just take a peek. I'd like to see what colour it is. We peeled off the rustling re-crap that encased it. I half expected it to come out moving, but when I first glimpsed a small patch of its side, it looked like grey plastic, anonymous dead. I went on unpeeling. Luke was mad with glee. Two protuberances appeared from the base that reminded me of the feet of a dodo, leathery, crudely detailed things, quite large compared to what the body must be. One of the cats was watching us, but it ignored the robot and jumped inside its packing, waving its tail disdainfully. Or perhaps the white plume was a flag of surrender. Luke tugged at my arm. Dad, Dad! What? I'm trying to get this stuff off. Is it a girl or a boy? God, I don't know. What do you want it to be? I want it to be like me. I nodded understandingly. Okay, it's a boy. No, he said indignant, I want a girl. No, you don't, I said, not entirely listening. The logic of children is often surreal. Oh, look, I say. For the head, when I got to it, was really tremendous. Now we saw our robot whole. It sat there, looking remarkably composed. A robust, short creature, around a metre tall. A little less, perhaps, than a three-year-old child. Its head was huge, childlike or bird-like. A baby bird's head in terms of its proportions. Its most notable feature, two big lidded eyes, which were currently turned down on the ground, giving a winning effect of shy good manners. It had stumpy legs and big flat feet. Its arms had a softer, velvety texture. There were numerous panels, buttons, indentations, both front and back, suggesting many talents. Hello, I said. I didn't mean to be facetious. I liked it at once and wanted to greet it. Dad, Dad, why isn't it moving? Said Luke, jumping up and down on the spot. Well, I don't know how we switch it on, I said. But I soon found out. It was delightfully simple. You pressed a little panel marked, Hello. Luke, do you want to switch it on? Or her, he said. He thought about it. I think he was suddenly a little bit afraid. No, he said. We've got to wait for Mummy. The miracle was Sarah liked it too. It appealed to her love of novelty. It appealed to her sense of humour too, the way they'd made it like a cartoon character. Its cheeky roundness, its big brainy head. It's almost too sweet to be useful, she said. Look at those lovely long Xylon lashes, so cute. Luke, switch it on now Mummy's here. Very tentatively, Luke pressed the panel, then stepped away smartly and we all waited. The first time, nothing happened. I think you should be firmer with it, Sarah said. You'd know, dear, I said, but she didn't hear me. She stretched out her small, strong hand and pressed, and a moment later, the dove quivered, whirred, and set off across the floor with the bandy gait of a drunken toddler, pausing minutely every now and then and whirring more loudly as if thinking. We watched it, all three of us, as proud as parents. It worked. It walked. We stood and adored. Then it reached a carpet, and the world went mad. There was a noise like a million electronic saws, and the carpet turned into a cross between a flying terrier and a boa constrictor, writhing and hissing like a white tornado, while the dove stood and fought it, rocking, grinding. Both cats fled yowling into the kitchen. Turn it off! Shrieked Sarah above the tumult. I did. We looked at each other, shaken. But Luke was grinning and shaking his head. It's not broken, he insisted happily. It's cleaned the floor wherever it stepped. We began to laugh. It's brilliant, said Sarah. Success beyond my wildest dreams. For a week or two, we were adoptive parents, enchanted to meet the new member of the family. This marriage breaks up, and Sarah, the mother, takes the child to live with a group of women who are at the center of a political party, which I call Wicca. A Wicca, without intending to, wins an election. It doesn't really intend to win the election, but voting figures by then are so low, since there's no central government spending, there's no, central government doesn't really exist, so nobody bothers very much about this election. And Wicca wins it more or less by accident and then doesn't entirely know what they want to do. And Sarah is at the center of this movement. Saul becomes increasingly desperate. He doesn't see his son for 3 years. And having been, in a sense, neutered for the first half of the book, he leads this curiously passive life. I think people who use computers endlessly almost lose their bodies. So although these men are very masculine and they're very grouped together as males, but they don't have the old sense of an epic hero, which I try and evoke at the beginning. They don't have any activity. And then Saul becomes so desperate, he decides to kidnap his son. He decides he's going to kidnap his son and take him back to Africa. Because Africa is where it's still warm, and because his child has some Ghanaian blood, he has automatic right of entry. As soon as he decides to kidnap his son, the book turns in a way into an adventure story. And Saul becomes dramatically masculine in a rather stereotypical way, but starts to have an awful lot more fun. And in a way, the book has a lot more fun. I had a great deal of fun writing these passages. But one of the things he discovers is that his son has been given hormones. His son has a very beautiful voice. His son is a tenor. And he discovers that his son has been given hormones to keep his voice, and also as part of a gender experiment. Shall I read you a little more from this, or shall I read from something else? Who would like me to read a little bit more from this? I'm very happy to pass on to another book. A little bit more? Have we still got time for questions?
Yeah,
okay. I suppose you never know who you are until your life is over. What you are is the sum of what you do, leavened with wishes, dreams, regrets. But I never knew half of what I could do until I was prized from my shell of habit. I found I could sail across the channel, which after all is a limb of the Atlantic. I could barter in French a boat for a car and not do too badly on the deal. I could come across as tough and taciturn. I could make people afraid of me. I could do without sleep and books and good food and buzzers and soothers and all the rest. I could live at a slower speed than before, rougher and slower because I had to. Cars in Euro were a different life form to the speedy hydrocars we drove at home. Since half of Paris had been burned to the ground in 2056, the year before our journey, by the explosion at the hydrogen plant at Boulogne-Billancourt, there had been no fuel for hydrocars. So the old bangers had come into their own, poor people's cars, essentially, a few still running on black market petrol, more of them adapted to run on alcohol that enterprising peasants brewed from plants. Hemp plants, mostly, after smoking the leaves. You soon got used to the sweet, choking smell. But the car we'd got hold of, a red, battered thing which had green and yellow fins painted on the back, did 40 kilometres an hour flat out, pretty average for a French Alco. And you couldn't go flat out through unfamiliar country where most of the signposts had been burnt for firewood. Sometimes it felt as if we were crawling, covering 80 kilometres a day. I began to understand what I'd never grasped when we flew all over Euro in less than half an hour, when we slid like silk over the surface of things, that the world was large and wild and hard. I could smash down the shutters of deserted houses, break in through other people's windows. I felt nothing looking at the scattered glass from a family photo in a brass frame. My family mattered more than them. I learned staying alive mattered more than anything, staying alive to protect my son. Once I broke in and found a middle-aged woman whimpering with terror in the kitchen. Her face was a slab of Tear Street white. I never looked her in the eye. I took what we needed as if she wasn't there and left her twitching, shivering, pleading. Perhaps she was mad and had been abandoned months ago by indifferent children. I forced myself to act, not think. But I've never quite forgotten the colour of her eyes, blackish green like an oiled mallard, and her greasy dark hair licked to her scalp. I could forage for food and always find something, always enough to keep us alive, for the fleeing French never took it all with them. There were always tins of chestnut puree or vacuum packs of langue de chat or apple compote or great wheels of cheese. We sometimes ate almost too well in the north on greasy pâtés or confit of duck, food that made poor Luke want to throw up, for he was used to Spartan vegetarian fare, but we nagged him to eat it, and sometimes he did. I could wring the neck of chickens. That was a shock how easy it was. Once you caught the damn things with their hysterical squawking and long scrabbling feet and outraged eyes, once you'd felt the pain of their steely peck on your naked hand, it was easy to kill them. I could pluck them too, once Bryony taught me. I could make a fire, lighting up every time, persevering even if the wood was wet, and cook whatever we found, very badly, either boiling it or burning it, in a cooking pot stolen in Normandy. I could drive the car for 8 hours at a stretch before I yielded the wheel to Bryony. Sorry, Bryony is a girlfriend. Then sleep in the back while she did her stint. I could travel with a loaded gun in my lap, and be ready to use it when we had to. The worst time was one day when Bryony was driving. I'd opened the window to chuck out some paper, and an old yellow bus at the very last minute veered purposefully across the road towards us. A dozen male faces, swarthy, avid, were suddenly staring into mine, and they would have forced us off the road, but I let them have it through the open window, blasted their windscreen, windows, faces. The noise inside our car was like the world ending. We swerved and screamed across the tarmac, and Bryony wrenched the steering wheel back just in time. I could kill people and not feel ashamed. I grew closer to Luke, slowly closer. I think he began to feel happier. I know he preferred this uncouth life to the terrible safety of the cocoon, which is the women's commune. I could be a father as I'd wanted to be. I could be a man. I was with my boy. Then something happened to change all that. They had given him hormones. Luke let it out. For a while, I felt nothing but hatred for women. For decades, of course, it had been considered normal for men and women to horm up. Mostly, it was women who wanted to be male. Not male exactly, but masculine. They wanted to steal our strength, our hardness. There were also the men who wanted to be female. Their numbers had grown more recently, since the women had taken the children away. Men were caught trying to infiltrate wicker, with newly swollen breaths and whispering voices. They were treated with terrifying ruthlessness, though many of them just wanted to be with children. Others, I think, were actually trying to be the women who'd rejected them, to become the women they could not have. Mostly it wasn't sinister, though God knows we men were all pretty confused. Of course we were confused. We were redundant. They had sperm on ice that would last for decades, defective most of it, but it would serve. And there was nothing better between our legs, they seemed to say, when their cold eyes appraised us. So men and women had been horming up or taking charge of their destiny, as the first immensely pompous book I read about the subject put it, since the beginning of our century. But the rules had always been very strict. No hormones were to be sold to anyone under 16. They were one of the last restricted drugs after the prescription system ceased to exist and all recreational drugs were made legal in the so-called Leary year, 2005. Women are sometimes more ruthless than men. I didn't suspect. I missed the signs. Of course, his incredible, thrilling soprano had survived too long. He'd stayed young too long. He was nearly 14. Why wasn't I suspicious? Once they used to cut the little boy's balls off, the poor little castrati singing their hearts out, but they'd done it to Luke with chemicals. I shouted at Bryony and Luke. Perhaps I broke a few things, I'm not sure. I demanded to know what Wicker had done. I was justified. They had drugged my son. The bitches wanted to rip his balls off. Any father would feel the same. When did Bryony admit it was hormones? I'd been shouting at her as if she was my wife. At some stage, she stopped sitting meekly on the grass, stood up and stared with those strange pale eyes. When she told me he'd been taking high-dosage estrogen and other subtler, more complex drugs, I started to swear and smashed a glass and then another and another, and Luke sat hunched, gnawing his fingers. We wanted to see if it made boys gentler, and Juno so adored his voice. Juno should be shot, garrotted. I hate you, you bastard, Luke suddenly shouted. I love my mum, and I hate you. I suppose I deserved it, and yes, it proved that the hormones had worn off, and my son was adolescent. The words proved it, but so did something else, for as rage and grief burst out of him, his clear voice suddenly fell apart, and through it a bullfrog honked, croaked, a clumsy, hoarse, uncontainable thing, the very first sign that his voice was breaking. And then I felt sad. And then I felt guilty, and most of my anger leaked away. It was nearly dark. We were all getting cold. You tell me, now that the ice has come, now it's getting dark, and the cities are ruined, and most of the galleries have been abandoned, and the theatres are full of snow. Now the ice lies white along the plastic letters that used to blaze the names of actresses in orange light across navy skies. Now hardly anyone reads or writes. Now the churches have bonfires on the altars and plastic sheeting in their stained glass windows. Now Buckingham Palace is a burnt-out wreck with its cellars swarming with secret police. Now the old are dead and the young know nothing. You tell me, what is the point of us? What was ever the point of us? Our struggling, quarrelling, suffering species, getting and spending, wasting, grieving. There was love, wasn't there? I know there was. That can't be the point, though. We loved so badly. Perhaps we were meant to be recording angels, ringing the earth with consciousness, mirroring it in our net of signs, solar singers, messengers. But our net tore, a tattered cobweb, and here I crouch with my stub of a pencil in a windowless cupboard that smells of piss, penned in the dark like a dirty beast, trying to scribble my small story. Okay, I'm going to leave it there. I have to tell you, though, that parents' dreams for children, of course, are not the ones that children follow. And Luke doesn't necessarily want to go to Africa, and nor does he go there. I also always try and find some kind of happy ending on the theory that life doesn't offer them. And so when we have a bit of power to make patterns, you know, there's some satisfaction in making a possible pattern of some kind. Shall we?
Well, before I call for questions from the audience, or indeed while the audience are thinking of their questions, perhaps I could invoke my sort of chairperson's privilege of asking you the first one. As I mentioned earlier, you're an active reviewer of other people's books, particularly in The Telegraph, but I think in other places as well. I wonder how helpful you yourself have found reviews of your books.
Helpful?
If at all.
Well, you sometimes get a sense. You get a sense when a lot of reviewers say the same thing. At least you learn how your book is being taken. And I think I learned a lot from the reviews of my first novel, Dying in Other Words. I learned that I was seen as experimental. And that actually was interesting to me, because I also realised the book was more difficult than I'd meant it to be. And as I've gone on writing, I've tried to make things... I don't see a value in difficulty if you can express the same thing more simply. So I learned that. On the whole, you see, reviewers write too fast. And on the whole, they write... You know, we all do it for money. We wouldn't do it without. So I think you're more likely to learn something from people who are reading your book without that agenda of having to make a piece that's entertaining or witty, good copy. I mean, a response that is moderate is not good copy. I do rather moderate reviews. That is to say, I do reviews that try and say what's in the book. And I think this is not terribly good copy. I'm never going to be a famous reviewer because, you know, you have to actually make your mark by doing something that's slightly absurd or over the top or whatever, but this isn't the best service to the book. And to me, the good thing I see about reviewing is that it helps to get books to readers, books that you think are good, or to warn them off books you don't think are so good. Mm. I think not many writers will admit to learning from their reviews, even if we do. There's always that, you know, no writers really like their reviews, I think.
A lot of them don't read them at all, of course.
They say they don't. I wonder.
Yeah. Do you think novels by women are reviewed differently from novels written by men?
Well, not all, but I have a theory that literary writing is seen as largely a male activity, and that writing by women tends to be reviewed more with reference to its subject matter, whereas writing by men tends to be seen as a primary literary activity. So style and structure is taken more seriously sometimes in men's writing, which is very annoying. We also tend to get reviewed in bunches, even now. But you can't see that across the board, because when you get to a certain level, I mean, Margaret Atwood's books are going to be reviewed seriously in terms of structure and style. But yes, I think it takes us longer to be taken seriously. Perhaps.
Let's open it up to questions from citizens.
Do you get people, your readers, writing to you and saying what they think of the book, or how do you find out?
readers, and they're doing it without being paid, it means you've really, in some way, affected them and touched them. And that is actually fascinating, because quite often the things they react to are not the things you thought were central to the book. And yet they give you an insight into what you've been doing. Yeah, I value that immensely. And any of you who, you know, do read and sometimes have that impulse to write to writers who you've liked, do it, because all the writers I know like that very much, I think, and get a lot from it. And keep those letters.
Yeah. Another question at the back, I think.
Yes. It was interesting what you said about you like to write happy endings. And the piece that you read from Lost Children, were the words, what's lost is never really lost, but it's found again. And I often find that you can also have a kind of spiral effect where what's lost becomes found, but it's found the difference.
Yes.
From what was originally lost.
Yeah.
Right. The question's about happy endings and spirally effects and things lost being found and the new novel.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah. I recognise your description of the novels, because quite often I've started more than one of my novels with characters splitting up, and it's like a double helix. I think they do. They spiral apart and then they come back together, but everything has changed in some way, so that it is possible for them to come together. I think about, have any of you read Sidney Bechet's autobiography? It's the most wonderful autobiography by a jazz player. It's marvellous. But one of the things he talks about is this idea that in life you always come back to the same point, that life is always circular, but the man who never goes away, who never really goes round the curve in the bend, he never understands the patch of ground where he began and where he will also end, whereas the person who goes away understands it. And I think I like circular form. I like to somehow return to the beginning and think that everything has changed. It's the same proposition. I often end with the same sentence. I end the book with the same sentence, but by that time I hope it will be understood differently. After all, it's the form of our life, isn't it? We come from nothing and go to nothing. So, but you hope something happens in between.
Any more questions?
Yes, Jeremy.
You mentioned alluding to epic beginning of this new novel. In the Burning Book in particular, you quite often fall into a hexameter rhythm, or choose to write in a hexameter rhythm, I should say.
Mm.
For example, a little passage here, which is quite characteristic, I think, in a way. And those who stare at our gods will all be one with our homeless. The meek will inherit the earth at the sinking end of the earth. They will all have become Hibagusha, the name that means they're nameless. The people we will not speak of will triumph after our death. I'm caricaturing the rhythm just a piggy line.
Sure.
And I realise this won't get onto the recording and I haven't been able to repeat it. Talk a bit about your choice of that pattern, that epic pattern in that novel and the your rhythm, use of rhythm elsewhere.
I think all my books are rhythmical. I think they could all be actually written in lines. I try and work like that, but I try and not make it obtrusive, because I felt in The Burning Book it was too obtrusive. I wanted it to be like that because The Burning Book is a novel which is written under the threat of nuclear war. It's written in the 80s when there was a sense of weapons arriving from America, when there was a sense that the Cold War had reached a dangerous stage, and various crises like the Iran hostages crisis. And I wanted a sense both of something like a heartbeat and of something inexorably driving the reader on. So I did want the rhythm for that, but then I found it was hard to escape. You know, I found it had sort of really become part of my style. That's not surprising, because I began as a poet. And I think it's rhetoric. Prose and poetry, they're both rhetoric. You're both choosing words to have an effect on an audience. And we're all bodily creatures. Rhythm is important, I think, for establishing an emotional contact and for... rhythm is just a very powerful tool. That's why epic storytellers always used it, and alliteration. I don't see why most of the effects you use in poetry can't also be used in prose. But obviously, prose allows you to break things up more, to become irregular, to offer plural possibilities of meaning too. For me, I couldn't have stuck with poetry because my poetry would have been much too regular in a too obsessionally neat way. Prose is good for me because it makes me spread things out. But my style is rhythmical. I understand writing as rhythmical. I'm always amazed reading other writers by how they can do it without using rhythm. I look at it and I think, now I'm going to do that. And sure enough, in one form or another, it will fall into a... I think at the moment I'm using a four-beat line, as it were. But you're right. And it was intentional in that book. It's always intentional. It's just somehow, you see, I don't see the point of writing fiction where the language could be a shopping list. I don't see the point of it. I love a lot of modern fiction. I love a lot of fiction. But sometimes I feel it reads like an accident. It reads like chat. And somehow I think the language should be more work than that. I really think it should. I think that's why we spend all our time working so hard at it, to make the language work in a different way. And the novelists I admire do that. Thank you for the question. Yes?
Is that where the complexity comes in? Because you were saying earlier that you didn't like the idea of making things difficult for saying them. Is it not in the vocabulary, but in the way words put together?
Yes. Instead of having, in Dying in Other Words in the Burning Book, I think I have very difficult structure, fractured structure. And also certain kinds of games I played. I was very influenced by Nabokov at the time, who is the great literary games player. And I became disenchanted with this, not just because I was a Faber novelist and very much perceived as a difficult novelist, but because I thought I had political objections to it, sincere ones, which is that I believe writing is for everyone. I want it to be for everyone. I don't like the way the novel is divided into highbrow and lowbrow, commercial, literary. I think it's an absurd distinction. Good writing should be good writing. But it can't just be the publisher's fault. It can't just be the fault of the marketing end. It must be also that to a certain extent, we writers are enjoying ourselves at the expense of the readers. So I thought, okay, I want to use all my literary training and as much of my intelligence as I can, but I want to turn all the work inside so it doesn't show. So I want it to look as though it's easy. I want there to be as much work there, but I want it not to frighten people away and not to be sort of, look at me, I'm clever. You know, look at me, there's a game, there's a joke. I wanted all that to go, really, and I wanted to just have a clear narrative voice. But because I still want to work it, I use the rhythm and also the structure. I try and make the structure poetic, but not difficult, that's all.
Well, in the extract you read us from your new novel, I mean, it struck me as I heard it that generically, I mean, there's a range of things going on. You've got the thriller, there is science fiction, there is dystopia and so on. Are you aware of crossing those boundaries, or would you not accept the distinctions between these categories of writing to start with?
Well, I think they're all useful. All genres become genres because people like them. People respond to certain kinds of writing. But I think it's more interesting to take a genre and change it. In a way, all my novels have been from different genres because that interests me and excites me. It's interesting to me to write a love story and then a book about war or whatever, and to try and use them to make a good book. But critics don't terribly like that. They want you to write the same kind of book, and they're rather puzzled, I think, if you write different ones. I'm aware of the genre, but I think there's so many interesting ideas in science fiction. If you listen particularly to science fiction writers talking, it's not so much the writing, which isn't always so interesting, but the ideas they're dealing with are so much more interesting than the ideas that most straight novels deal with. They are, you know, big ideas about the way human life is lived and about the way it will be lived. They're often very, very thoughtful. in terms of what they're dealing with. So it's not at all a genre I despise. I think it's very under-reviewed, as a matter of fact. But whether this will be treated as science fiction, I don't know. I hope not.
More questions? Down here.
I see in your brief biography here that you have an M.Lit. On English surrealism. And I was curious to know if this youthful interest influenced your writing. Maybe the early writing.
I think they were great. They had such a good time, the surrealists. But, you know, they were a group and they did these extraordinary things, whereas I live a very quiet life and, you know, operate on my own. So I don't know, only in that I wanted to be flash when I started writing. I wanted to be experimental and break new ground. And, you know, you're more exhibitionistic then, really. And then the surrealists didn't stay surrealists on the whole, most of them. Probably you don't keep up that kind of energy, I don't know. I like their politics too, but you know.
Yeah. Another question up here on the right.
Oh yeah, sorry, yeah. I can't see very well, yeah.
The work of yours I know best is Light Years, and I was very struck and remain struck by the very vivid scientific metaphors and imagery, and also the extremely rich characterization. Is there any sense in which one or the other of those came first? Did you start with a feeling for a character, or did you start with one of the scientific images, or is that a non-question? Did they germinate together?
Sort of, yeah.
Sorry, it's a question about the use of science and the characterization in Light Years.
It's my happiest book. I was extremely happy when I wrote it. I think it was the first year I was married, and we were very free. We didn't have a child at the time. And I wanted to write a love story because I'd written The Burning Book, which is this kind of vast anti-war book and very gruelling. And I wanted to write a love story. At the same time, I'd gone back to the... I was born in Bournemouth on the coast, in Poole, actually. And I'd had to go back there. This is, you know... Books, of course, come from biography. My husband was writing a book about Robert Louis Stevenson, who, if you don't know, he wrote Jekyll and Hyde down in Bournemouth. We both went back, and I kind of fell in love with it all over again, with the natural world, really, and started reading a lot about the natural world, about, well, you know, biology, and about also about astronomy, because my mother-in-law taught me to look at the stars, you know, lie out in the deck chair and look at the stars. And these things all came together, and I thought, you can't write a love story today, surely. It's too small. And then I thought, but it would be great fun to write a love story and set it in a sort of cosmic frame, really, and get some kind of tension. In a sense, that relates to surrealism, because surrealists like to make collages, putting the unlike together. And I thought, if you have a sort of very, a cosmic frame, if you like, you can show how little human beings are. And if you show a pattern, the natural patterning of things, it's set over a year. It has 12 sections and 52 chapters. So there's a very strong patterning. But and only human beings somehow are out of tune, aren't they? So they came together, really. But it was partly I was having my own love story, and so I wanted to write one, I think. Science, in fact, I think science is so exciting too. As you know, I review as much science for the Telegraph as fiction, and there's so much good popular science writing going on now. I really don't know why people read novels with all that there is going on.
Yeah. More questions, please. Yeah, one up here.
You seem to have a very clear idea of what you're writing about. How often do you actually really surprise yourself? You know, you write something and then you read back and you think, where did that come from?
Oh, completely. I don't really know. You know, I'm just pretending I do because I have to talk, you know, I'm saying what I've realised afterwards or what I hope makes a good, an account that's coherent. But I think anyone who is writing and excited by what they're writing doesn't really know everything that's going on, and it wouldn't be good writing if you were writing it, you know, to a formula. I don't think it would work awfully well because things come from the words, you see, don't they? I know there are other writers here. I mean, do you find that, Maureen, when you're writing, that things, it sort of comes alive as you write or something? And you certainly don't know the connections to your own life, I think, at all. You're not aware of them, are you? Or until maybe somebody points them out. I think that's a good thing. I think it's good not to know.
Right, time's running short. We've perhaps time for a couple of very short questions, if we're not all questioned out by this stage.
Can I ask one about the Finnish novel, reading to us as just have from something which is finished? Is it completely finished now, or will you expect to, it sounded finished, but would you expect that Richard Cohen would have some...
Actually, at 9 o'clock tomorrow, Richard Cohen is going to be having some input into it because we're having a final edit. So, I expect some. I think everybody needs an editor. I think it's arrogance to say you don't need any editing because other people can always come up with something. And I think it's natural to defend yourself against it and reject it all and then later to accept some. I mean, people pick up things, inconsistencies or whatever, and they also perhaps tell you things you haven't put in that you hoped you had. You might have thought a character was fully fleshed out, and actually a lot of it is in your head. So I think a sympathetic editor is enormously valuable, and it's rather tragic that publishing has sacked so many of its editors. In fact, I had a very brilliant editor for Lost Children, a wonderful editor who... tragically killed himself. And you do miss that. I think writers need editors, and the editing that you get in creative writing classes, I should think, is valuable to the people who are writing here as students, is it? I hope so. It's probably the most careful editing you'll ever get, actually. No, I thought I'd get a bit of, you know.
Well, maybe we could close, or maybe you could, Maggie, by telling us what you're writing there. I understand there are various projects.
Yes. Well, it's always hard to describe the different things you're doing. I'm working on a novel about a racial murder, which is very difficult to do, actually, but also interesting, like everything else. I don't know. I just hope the books go on being different, really.
Well, thank you very much.